Accession number 20459, Reel 17.
Captain Spencer, Reel 17. I was asking you about food supplies, and particularly about rice.
Well, we were told that a large quantity of rice for distribution throughout the whole of my territory was due to arrive in a few days' time, and plans were being made to put it into a big warehouse where it would then be distributed. I wasn't too happy about this arrangement because I felt that there was room for the place finding itself to places and it would get on the black market and everything else. And since the area was very clearly divided into different communities under different headmen, I myself and other members, I dispatched these various people to ask whether if they had the rice directly there, the chieftain himself would make sure that it was immediately. So in other words, right on the first day, the rice would get to the people and I would make sure that it was delivered to the areas where it was going. There were quite a large number of army people in there, and there's a fellow called Brigadier Hanley, I think his name was, and I asked him as to whether he explained the situation to him, whether he could arrange for troops and vehicles to be ready when the rice was to do, and we would allocate a quantity of rice to each truck to be delivered to various places. I hadn't got too long to do it, but luckily the delivery of the rice was delayed for a little more time, so I was able to get this set up. The warehouse had been unnerved, and he was complaining bitterly that, you know, that if he wasn't going to see the rice, he was going to lose his money, obviously. However, the rice arranged, and I must say that the army turned up absolute trumps. They were right there on the tab. They'd borrowed trucks from other areas, and certainly more than sufficient. We'd got the quantity of the rice, and we knew how many sacks would go on a lorry. We knew the roughly the population of each of the particular areas. So that virtually within 24 hours of the rice being delivered, it was, what's the name, and, you know, I was obviously very popular with the local what's-name, because this rice had gone. However, I got a hell of a rocket from Seremba and saying, you were told that this place, you know, was to be delivered to so-and-so, and the people there have complained that they haven't seen it, and so forth and so on. However, I think I was able to satisfactorily say, well, I thought the idea was to distribute rice to the population. Well, I don't know about other areas, but my rice has been satisfactorily delivered, and you can come round and inspect to make sure there's no what's name. So I was very pleased with that particular operation. Things were then sort of moving ahead. Quite a bit of time had gone by. Normal activities were taking place. I mean, I used to kick off the local football matches. But the other amusing thing really was that apart from being collector of land revenue, and I was also the magistrate, which a magistrate at such a very young seemed to amuse me. However, the clerk of the court was a very well, although he'd been under the Japanese, he appeared to me to be quite a nice and certainly very knowledgeable fellow. So I used to sit on the high bench looking over the pulpit, so to speak, and these various people would be brought in for their misdemeanors, and I said, you've been a very naughty boy, and I'd start to laugh and I'd have to disappear out of the place. Plus I had my the law books there, and to my mind that it was painfully obvious often if people were guilty. it amused me that my powers of authority was I could give a $2,500 fine. I could send somebody to prison for 2.5 years. Or I could give 12 lashings of the whip. I thought, oh, that should be quite exciting, I imagine. Anyway, so we had a lot of minor cases because, you know, things didn't go to trial. There was summary justice over the workmen.
What were the sort of prevalent cases?
The prevalent cases of stealing a pig, being caught thieving something or other, sort of an argument between neighbours, all the petty little things that would happen in a village. If there was there was one case of murder which came up, which I couldn't try, but there was a hearing whereby somebody discovered his wife with the man, and he killed her, and according to all the tribal customs and everything else, he was fully justified in doing so. But of course, I couldn't. He was locked up in jail, and I did speak to him, and he said, "Well, you know, this is unfair." Again, my Malay was coming a little better. But there's nothing I could do about it. But I, in many ways, I thought it was fair. But he was. I don't know what actually happened to him. But he then went for trial elsewhere. The local police chief was a fellow called Peter Masham Cook, who was a bit of a smart aleck, I was going to use the word, but, you know, a well-educated captain, and he was the police officer concerned. But often he would present, the case would not be presented correctly, that the sort of, the evidence didn't hold together.
Yes.
All this had to be recorded, and if it didn't match up and there was appeal, it would be thrown out. And I kept telling him, you know, that his police have got to present the thing, because I kept having to throw out a lot of his cases because they just didn't hold together. The fellow may or may not have, they weren't of major importance. But I found that sort of ordinary rough justice was really quite satisfactory. If it became too complicated, then I would often sort of ask for it to be, you know, taken to a higher court. But normally they were just domestic issues locally.
The policemen, were they local?
The policemen were, apart from two white officers, all local people, yeah.
In this area, did you ever have any serious threat to public order?
Well, yes, at this time, the troubles were arising. Occasionally there was shooting, you know, from roads. I didn't have too much trouble, but one of the incidences were, I was very lucky in obtaining an Indian who was a Tamil who had a tremendous gift to language. Not only was his English very, very good, but he spoke a number of Indian dialects, but also he spoke Cantonese, which was the most unusual what's name. So I got him from another area. I can't think why. He wanted to join his friend down, and he then came to me for a job. Nobody knew anything about him, so I made him swear that he never let anybody knew that he spoke Cantonese. He was Emil's. He had the most remarkable retentive memory, apart from his what's name. But because there were sort of illicit trading and that sort of thing, I would often go into the various Chinese shops and ask them, did they know about this thing? And, you know, they would be all nodding their head and this, that, and the other, and, you know, have you seen this particular thing, so and so. And we'd walk out, and I said, well, what did they say? And he said, well, did I tell them what they did say? And I said, yes. He said, well, you know, that silly bastard's coming again. What are we going to tell him today? You see? So there were, nobody would believe. So I got so much information from this fellow of what they. So if we were trying to discover some goods, stolen goods or lots of name, and they it would quite happily do, you know, have you got rid of the stuff or so and so. So they can never understand why they got a lot of people got caught not telling them things. The other thing was that at various days the local guerrilla movement would tell them to shut the shops. So I would go round saying, well, you know, you've got to open the shops. And of course they would open up, and then directly I went past, of course, the people that closed them down again. So we played this game for some time. But I personally didn't... I found that in my area particularly, we didn't have the... In the remoter areas, in the rubber plantations and everything else. But also I had the responsibility of issuing the rubber dealing licenses, which were very important at this particular stage. I had by then made a very good friend of a Chinese businessman in the area who was a most charming person, again fluent in English, and had a very successful there. He also, more importantly, had a very, very charming daughter who really was absolutely marvelous. And during a dinner one night, he said, I'm putting in for a application for a rubber dealing license. I said, oh, yes. I said, no. And he said, well, if you give me this license, I'll give you $50 a week for it. So I said, I wish you hadn't said that. He said, why? He said, I don't mind paying him. I said, but you should know that as colonial officials, we're just not able to take anything. It's a great pity, because I would have seen no reason why you couldn't have had a rubber dealing license, but I'm afraid now there's no way that you're going to get one. Now, he couldn't understand that. He'd made a generous, friendly offer, and I said, no, I'm sorry, you can't do it, and he was, quite astounded. It marred our friendship for a slight period of time, but not unduly. But this is one of the other things. A lot was talked about colonial fishing, but I didn't even permit myself to accept a bowl of oranges. You had to be whiter than white in terms of the what name. And this, not only in Malaya, but I found was applicable to other colonial countries, that there may be a lot of commercial what's name, but as far as the administrators were concerned, they had a very high code of honour. So Tampin was a very interesting spot.
You mentioned the guerrillas trying to intimidate shopkeepers.
Yeah.
And you said there was occasional bit of shooting in the remoter areas.
Yeah.
Did you have any sources, local sources of intelligence about the Chinese communists in Malaya and their activities? And
yes. I had myself a number of people that were Malays who would go to the at various times to the various areas to know whether there was any activities. So we used to get that a body of people had transferred, from A to B.
Mm. Did you have a special branch detachment in your...
Not really. I just had a number of blokes who were working for me and paid a sum of money to do various things. I mean, I want to know what was happening at a particular thing, or if there'd been an accident, and will they go and see what's happened, or if there's a bridge been damaged, or... In other words, you couldn't be everywhere yourself, so they would go and look at the situation if I couldn't go and look at myself. But this, again, I found that you could do a lot to help people. This communication that you're talking about, it happened. I mean, if, for instance, one of the villages that somebody had been injured or what's the name, the information would come to me. And even if I couldn't get one of the civilian doctors, the army present would... send somebody or do something. There was quite a degree of cooperation. There's only one other thing, that again, in Tampin, I was the billeting officer, unfortunately, Colonel Hilliard went, which was again after the war, and I had another brigadier come to the office. At that time, I'd got rid of all signs of army rank because I felt it wasn't, I didn't carry a gun anymore, and I sort of tried to get back to the sort of old colonial style. And this fellow walked straight into my office as a Spencer or something. I said, I beg your pardon. I said, go out at once and knock on the door. I'm a representative of the British government here. Now go out. So he disappeared and knocked on the door and came in. I said, now, can I help you? He said, well, I'm the new... I said, oh, that's all right. So I said, but, you know, it's very important, you know. I don't want to give you a lecture. But the people here, we're trying to run local... the army is no longer of any importance. And this, he was quite chastened. He must have really... If he knew I was a captain out of uniform, he would have really enjoyed the day. So he said, well, I want a, billet. So the colonel, the Brigadier Hillier, had a place which had been, strangely enough, occupied by somebody else temporary. So I thought, well, I'm not going to give him this place or phone. So I gave him a not nearly so nice place anyway. And we had a few little tiffs. But I mean, there's nothing, in those days, the whole impression was of trying to get back.
Civilian
and people
government.
Hobnooling their boots all over the place and sort of being terribly dictatorial wasn't the way we wanted the general appearance to go.
What was the army doing at that stage in Malaya? Was it conducting any active operations, or was it...
Well, at this particular stage, I mentioned to you earlier that there was the Japanese camp there, so they
yes.
were doing guard duties. Mm. But at that particular stage, apart from holding parades and playing football matches and anything else, at that time, again, the resurgence of the guerrillas in Malaya hadn't really taken place. So that their functions were fairly negligible. As far as I was concerned, we weren't having any trouble in our area, so we didn't need to. But on the general rule, if I wanted transport done, or various tasks done, or the engineers to come in to do something, to act as a civilian help or repair a road or something of that nature, I got generally tremendous cooperation because they had the equipment, the time and the expertise, so that was useful.
You mentioned that you had to get roads and railways running. Were the roads and railways in basically reasonable condition, or did you have to undertake major schemes to repair?
As far as Malaya was concerned, there was some, but I can't see evidence of a great amount of repair work. There was certainly a few bridges and things done, but I, right from the start, because the collapse was so sudden and complete, that demolition hadn't even taken place. I think that those bridges that had to be repaired were not on the main routes and in the wild areas. It was bringing the guerrillas out of the hills, which was slight difficulty. There were. I met a person there who had been dropped in, a Chinese, with whatever money he was given to do so, and he'd created business in the area and was providing vital information to the Allies. But in the meantime, had built up a very, very successful number of businesses throughout the year, built on his British money. So when they said he was no longer wanted, he said, on the contrary, I'm now very nicely here, thank you very much. They wanted the £20,000 return. I don't know whether they ever got it or not, but I don't suppose they did.
What was the general condition of the civil population? Were they in reasonably good order when you arrived?
Compared with India, the general state of health was very reasonable. Being such a, I mean, rice was still plentiful. As far as the meat, I mean, there were wild pigs in the what's name. So, my experience was that the general condition of the population, both Malays and Chinese, were in reasonable health, and also they had a very good tribal family relationship. That if people were not in not after the you know, they would be looked after rather like in the Jewish faith by other people and so forth, or like the Scots people. So now, on the whole, that I mean, there were circumstances, and we were able in where a particular area was for some reason had had a failed crop or something else, we could move goods to help them out. I can't think that there was anything like the problems in like in Biafra or other third world countries.
Were there any shortages that you were aware of critical importance?
Yes, there were shortages of tars and various other things. The cars I had, one particular instance was getting hold of tars was very important. But when I went there, that the each area had a rest house, an allocation, which it had a budget for. A rest house enabled people, so that they're travelling through, so you're entitled to a cook and a cleaner or something of that nature. Well, I decided, because I was living on army pay, to create my house as the rest house. I was able to have a cook and a servant paid by the government. Plus, there were two Red Cross nurses in the area, which a photograph I showed you of, called Helen McCurdy and Bargery, somebody or other. So I decided they should live in my house, because then I'll get the pay for the what's name. So my household was treated as a guest house, and funds were therefore officially available in order to provide the funds for it. But on one occasion, I remember we're coming back from Seremban at the club there. There was Helen McCurdy, myself, and the Sice in the car. And as we were coming back, I looked over down into the not the valley, but a lower lying land, and there was an elephant feeding off crops in this particular village. I told the driver to stop, and I thought, well, you know, this is something that we need to do to clear it out, because it would seem it was called a rogue elephant. Anyway, so I walked back down the road and foolishly shouted at the elephant that it would make any difference. But after a short space, to my surprise, it turned round and started lumbering towards me. So I thought, time I went. So I walked very quickly up the road and looked behind me, and it was climbing up the bank. So the last few yards I ran, got into and said to the driver, now just pull away quietly. Anyway, he stalled the engine. I was screaming, and I said, now just very quietly, you know, turn the engine on again and just get moving. I'm looking out of the window. This elephant was getting closer and closer. But however, he pulled away, and to my great relief, I mean, one car wouldn't have been particular protection against a very large elephant. So we got back to the house, and I organized for the troops to come out to try and do this. And we went back. Unfortunately, we had no huge guns, however, we did fire at the thing, and we were able to chase it away. I wasn't very satisfied with that. It either should have been, you know, humanely killed. I don't know whether it was badly injured or not. I mean, a bullet 303 doesn't affect much to us. But anyway, we chased it away. The one of the other instances that I had a 1500 weight truck besides the MG sports car and an Austin 7, and I'd had a hell of an argument on the phone with an official at head office in Seremban, the government office. And I was very upset at this. I got in my car and drove the 20 miles to the club. Got into the club and sitting at the bar, nobody else there, and who should come in but the fellow had an argument with
him. Do you remember what the argument was about?
It was about distribution, again, of food. I hadn't obeyed a directive, and I said, well, I thought, he said, well, you're always doing things of this nature. You just don't, you know. So he'd upset me, and I shouted at him, probably quite wrongly. However, we then made it up in the car, in the club, and promised to be trying a bit more patient with each other in future. I then, because it was a warm night, had the windscreen of the 1500 weight open. You know, it tilts up.
Yes.
The fresh air. I knew this stretch of the road particularly well. I knew what speed I could take the various bends. And in the middle of this trip was an S bend, which I could take about 54 miles an hour or something, or close to. But as I was going around one half of the bend, there was a whole number of pigeons in the middle of the road which flew up. And one came through the open windscreen and hit me in the face, which was more than enough to distract me. I then realized that I wasn't probably going to make the next corner. If I continued to turn, the vehicle would
roll over.
So I decided to straighten the wheel and go straight. I'd forgotten that was about a 25-foot drop. Plus, there were trees all the way down. But luckily, because of the speed I was going at, I threw through the tops of these fir trees. I must have carried it, probably descending slightly, for about 25 feet to lie in a paddy field, which was, and sunk to the axles in the paddy field.
You were stuck.
The only damage to the truck was the fact that where my head had hit, there was a sort of like a cupola shape on the roof of the what then. So I got out and climbed back through the trees. I mean, the trees then were that sort of size. I mean, if I hadn't flown in, it would have been quite a disaster. But this became quite an incident. People came from half of the countryside to see where Tony had flown a 1500 weight. And of course, it took them days to get the vehicle out because they had to cut so many trees down to try and it was fairly embedded in this thing. So it became quite a go and see Tony's flying what's name. So that's an incident I remember.
How was it that you eventually went to Borneo? Having been in
well, that more or less covered. What happened is then James Calder, who I had
you'd had the argument with him.
Well, no, but he I think respected me. I'd done a lot of work for him, and I think he was, and also because of the being the, one of the other incidents, just very briefly, is that that Tunku Abdul Rahman, who was the future Prime Minister, so was a local, what's name, and I didn't know, I'd been to see him several times, but I didn't realise he was English educated and what's name, because I always spoke to him in Malay, was going to open a new school in Rembau, where this particular bloke I'd had arguments with before, told to do. And I've got the letters here. His Excellency had said, you know, Tony, or rather, Calder said, well, you know, I'm sorry I can't make. Would you sort of, you know, do it? So I arranged for this school to be opened and welcomed Tunku Abdul Rahman, which I've got a photograph here too. And so the various, and I